Welcome to the Horror Screens Podcast, an extension of the Horror Screens Video Vault website. I am your host, Peter, alongside Stephen.
Hello!
Yes, we are still here. We are surviving the dreaded pandemic that is out there. How are you going on with it, Stephen?
Yeah, all right, thank you. Yeah. Right as rain.
Yes.
Acid rain, that is.
Well, you never know what could happen next, do you? That's the thing. Right.
Bit paranoid, bit twitchy. Trust no one.
As long as you've got your toilet roll and your hand sanitizer, you'll be fine.
A trip to the shop is like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Like, he could be one of them.
Yeah, they'll point at you. He's got pasta.
Ah.
But, yeah, so obviously we got a bit... A lot of people taking it seriously, as they should, but a lot of these situations, there's a lot of people... not taking it seriously, which happens a lot with these sort of situations. But hey ho, we'll have to wait and see what happens in a couple of months. Who knows, Stephen? We could be doing this in a shed at the bottom of a garden sometime.
We could, yeah, absolutely. There's a risk of that. I'm really worried about Prince Charles, though, because basically the poor sap, he's got it, and he's self-isolating on his Highland estate in Scotland, which means that basically this poor bastard is confined to 53,000 acres of land.
Yeah, no, and he hasn't got any money. How's he
gonna survive? I doubt there'll be a respirator for him if he needs it. So, yeah, let's just have a moment of silence for Prince Charles.
So, this episode, we're going to be talking about... we're going to talk about the stuff, Stephen. That's our Retro Rewind, which was 1985, I want to say. That's
how low in calories, good taste, and it doesn't even spot.
Yeah, great taste for today, tastes great every way.
You can't get enough.
Oops. Oh, the stuff.
One lick is never enough.
Enough is never enough, Stephen.
It's never enough. No. I'm eating the stuff right now.
Don't do that, Stephen. You got a podcast to record first.
Oh.
Yes, as we were just saying before we went on a tangent, this episode is sponsored, but no, it's not. This episode is about the stuff. 1985, done by Larry Cohen, and the rest of the episode is going to be talking about Larry Cohen and his career. Here, there, and everywhere, but Retro Rewind would be our main thing, which I've seen countless times, and I imagine Stephen's seen a fair few times as well.
Yeah, it had a great... I think it always had that cover, right? The big open mouth with the stuff coming out. Did it always have that cover on VHS?
I don't... it's like a... Yeah, the bloke's mouth stretching open.
Chocolate Chip Charlie.
Yeah, Chocolate Chip Charlie. But before we go into that, Steve, before you get to dig into the stuff, we're going to do what we've recently seen.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to mention a couple of things which I'm guaranteed you would have seen, actually. And one of them is Blackwater from 2007.
Oh, yeah.
I rewatched that because somebody wanted to borrow it from me. So I thought I'd watch that. So that, if you haven't seen it, most people would know it as the film where a bunch of people are stuck up in a tree in the Florida Everglades, or is it? No, it's not. It's Australia, isn't it? Somewhere, I think.
Yeah, it's like the mangrove swamps of somewhere in Australia.
Yeah, so a bunch of people stuck in a tree with an alligator chasing after them and eating them, basically. So to do it as a double bill, I watched that, and because I hadn't watched it, I watched Crawl as well.
Nice.
Which was an awesome double bill. And I think you watched it at the cinema, didn't you?
I love Crawl. Yeah, that is a great double bill. I didn't know you'd watch those together. That's fantastic. Crawl's great. They're both great, actually. Blackwater's really good.
Well, Crawl was done by Alexandre Aja, which many people would know for Halt Tension, amongst other things, but most people would know him for that, I would have thought. But yeah, it makes a great double bill. And if you're looking for, I don't know, sort of alligator crocodile films, I would highly recommend putting both of those on top of your list. Don't confuse Blackwater with the other film that's called Blackwater, which has Jean-Claude Van Damme in it, and I believe Dolph Lundgren, which is an action thriller movie from about 2018. So,
good God.
Don't confuse yourself with those two. So there are some other things as well, but I'll let Stephen take the lead for a minute.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Recently seen. Well, before they closed the cinemas due to some chicanery happening, I watched The Invisible Man, which is the new version from Universal Studios.
1938.
Yeah, finger on the pulse of the culture. So this is great, actually. What I liked about this whole thing is that Universal Studios were planning to create their dark universe.
They did, Stephen. They did such a good job. The Mummy. And teasing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, with Russell Crowe popping up in The Mummy for no reason except to go, oh, blimey, I'm open for a spin-off. They realised that nobody gave a shit about the Dark Universe, so they thought, oh, balls. And they instead got Blumhouse to make a pretty low-budget film called The Invisible Man, which is a really cool take on the old H.G. Wells story. Very different to all the others. It's based in a kind of realistic domestic violence story. And it becomes really, really suspenseful. There's a couple of moments in The Invisible Man, which is directed by Lee Whannell, who's very good and did Upgrade, which we loved a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Created Saw and Insidious. So the man's actually a really likable guy when you watch him in interviews and hear him on the commentary. He's totally unpretentious, almost kind of astonished that he's become extremely wealthy from creating these things that started out on a low budget level. And it's a really good version. It's got a couple of really great shock scenes. The special effects are really minimal, but really well done. And it has Elizabeth Banks in a great performance as the abused wife whose husband seems to be dead, but he still comes back in a visible form for reasons that become clear later on. Invisible Man was awesome and was doing very well, and then the cinemas closed and nobody could watch it. It literally became invisible.
It came invisible, yes.
Although it is on demand. You can pay $15.99 to watch it at home on Amazon.
All right.
It's one of those films that they are trying, well, I guess they're trialing what the studios always secretly wanted to do, which was, can we save loads of money on marketing and all that stuff and just shove films straight on demand? And now they're forced to because they've got nothing else to do. So you can watch The Hunt and Invisible Man and I think the new version of Emma on demand for about £15, $20 in the US.
All right.
Which is an interesting model, you know, in terms of the future of watching films, especially if all the cinemas is infected.
Yes, I did like the look of The Invisible Man when the sort of teaser trailer and other trailers came out. So I was hoping it was going to do, you know, quite well. Obviously, it has been doing well until this big old pandemic that's happened. But
it was doing really well. And I watched it with a guy, Pete knows this, but I watched it with a guy who's notoriously squeamish about horror films. And that's part of the pleasure of going to watch horror films with him in the cinema, because we work together and we live right next to the cinema. We don't live next to the cinema. I mean, we work next to the cinema. And you always know if something's really working, because you can see in the corner of your eye him acting like a seven-year-old girl and squealing. And there is a couple of genuinely moments of Christ in The Invisible Man where you think, wow, that was really well done. So hearty recommend.
Well, it's been on my list for however long.
Yeah.
So I'll get around to watching it. So a couple of other things that I've been watching. One of them, actually, I think you've seen both of them. One was Scarecrow County, which was done by John Oak Dalton, who did Girl in the Crawl Space.
Yeah.
Which was a low-budget horror movie, which features this it's supposed to be a murderous scarecrow. There's a lot of dialogue in the film. It's very character-driven.
Yeah.
Not a lot of gore. So I'd imagine people see the title Scarecrow and probably the poster, and they're expecting it to be, well, like the Scarecrow films. But it's not. But I liked both of them. I don't think I've ever seen anything else of his, but Girl in the Crawl Space, I liked. Scarecrow County, I liked. And I think a Jurassic Prey sounds familiar.
Ooh.
I think that's something else he did as well. Or unless he wrote it or something. But there was that, which I think you reviewed it, didn't you?
Yeah, his movies are interesting. Yeah, I rather like Scarecrow County. It's an acquired taste because, like you said, it's unusually character-driven. So the spooky, scary, gory stuff doesn't really happen until about an hour in. It's only about an hour and a quarter from what I remember. But the guy is interesting. The writer's director, he does write films that at least attempt to develop sympathetic, realistic characters. And I quite like that approach because he does it rather well.
That's what I liked about both the films is they're actual characters that you could, there's a girl in this small town, girl who works as a librarian, who comes across a lost diary of a teenager who killed himself, and then it exposes the secrets of this town that's slowly falling apart because jobs are going elsewhere. But
yeah, that's what I like.
Her character was somebody, if you went into a library, you could talk to and you would enjoy talking to. She felt more like a real person as opposed to here's some cannon fodder or here's the character that's got to explain everything.
Yeah. And there's the sister. Is it the sister who's the agoraphobic comic book artist?
Yes.
Part of that. Yeah. It makes real good effort to be interesting and to fill in time before the scarecrow pops up. And like you said, it's a good portrait of a very common American town that's economically collapsed, and people who always expected to move away never did, or they come back because they have no choice.
So John Oak Dalton is his name, if you want to look him up. He's definitely a director or writer to check out. And another film I've watched recently was Thomas Lee Rutter, who did a film called Day of the Stranger, which was that drama, fantasy, western, thriller, excerpt every other genre possible into the title, which was shot all over the world, and it basically follows a guy who's a bounty hunter who wants to do one last, he has to do one last job to basically get a big payoff, but he comes across a character who's a bit odd, shall we say. But apparently it's loosely based on a short story by Mark Twain.
Wow.
So basically took the whole idea, and it's shot all over different parts of the world. You can tell where certain places are shot, like America and whatever else, and I think Morocco is one of the places, and Wales, which is, I think that's one of the things it was being advertised as the first Western film to be shot in Wales or something. But it's done in that sort of 1970s Western style, and obviously I think everybody in the film is British, but they're all putting on American accents. And unless you knew, really, a lot of them you probably it's the American. But I've seen quite a lot of them in other stuff, so I know that they're actually English. But
yeah,
I think you reviewed this as well, and it was at Horror on Sea Film Festival this year, I believe, and I think it went down reasonably well. But what did you think of it?
I really liked it. It was really distinctive. It was, if you're a fan of spaghetti westerns or things like El Topo, with these kind of weird, surreal, sort of arty, but really kind of bizarre western things. Yeah, it was really good fun, especially as it was done on such a low budget. The music's really good, and the, like you said, the strange accents and the strange overdubbing and the really peculiar characters and the long scenes of not much happening, and then the big gory kind of burst of action. It was a nice tribute to that kind of stuff. I did have that weird, trippy kind of acid trip western that it was obviously trying to be from the early 70s, late 60s kind of thing. I really liked that.
If the name sounds familiar to some people, the director did Feast for the Beast, which was about 2008, was it? Somewhere around there? Like 2010.
One with Caroline Munro, right?
Yes. It seems like such a long time ago now.
Yeah.
But there we go. And that's other than our main talking point shortly, and other stuff, that's my what I've been watching recently. So what else have you been watching, Steven?
I was watching The Hunt, which again, actually The Hunt was the last film I saw before the cinemas all shut down around here.
And Locked The Hunt out.
The Hunt is this movie which has arrived with a big poster saying, "Whoa, you know, for the movie that they didn't want you to watch because it was delayed."
The movie they didn't want you to watch so much so they let out a pandemic and shut the cinemas.
So they did. So no one can watch it now.
A terrible
now,
marketing
how do you like
plan.
Them apples. Yeah, exactly. That's it. You know, these days there's so many things out that no single movie tends to create much controversy anymore. And this really didn't, but it was a movie that, because of its subject matter, there was some rumblings. And I think Donald Trump, who hadn't seen it because it hadn't come out, muttered something about it being irresponsible. So they were eventually they delayed it. And I think something happened. Probably one of America's daily shootings happened and delayed it. And they released it in March with the thing of, you know, original release date crossed out September 2019. Yeah, it's quite fun. It's this kind of Saw-ish like scenario of 12 people waking up in a strange location. No idea of how they got there or what the purpose is of them being captured and they're being hunted. But what it really is a kind of political satire stroke horror movie with loads of gore. Like there's a couple of gore blimey moments that you don't quite expect in a mainstream film. But the cool thing about it, I suppose, is it kind of captures the divide in America really well, because it portrays the Hillary Clinton supporters and the Trump supporters as both ridiculous grotesques. So apart from one character, which is the lead character, they're all a bunch of idiots. You know, they're all broadly played. You're like, oh, crap. You know, it's real caricatures, but it does it really well. It's written by the guys behind Lost, like I think it's Damon Lindelof. Who?
Does that mean the movie's
going to
go on and on and on for ages, and then at the very end they go, oh, it was what I said was going to happen.
They're in purgatory. Yes, it's 40 hours long, and it feels 80 hours long. So it's good fun. It's not spoiling it, actually, because her name's all over the movie, but you don't see her. You don't actually physically see her until near the end. But Hilary Swank is like this CEO of a company. And the main twist about her role in all of this is actually a really clever joke, as is the leading character, who you think is just some kind of brain dead redneck Trump supporter, but actually, you know, turns out to be far from it. It's got some good jokes. It's got some really good gore. And it also has a fantastic fight scene, which is basically a reworking of the Great Kitchen scene in Kill Bill Volume 1.
All right, yeah.
And it's really obviously based on that, but it's so well done that you think, oh, well, you know, this is a ripoff, but at least it's done so well. So The Hunt, yeah, well worth a watch. It was, again, it was around in cinemas, but now it's going to be available on demand, and I'm sure the price will come down the longer it's out, so you can still watch it quite easily.
Mm. Well, depending on, I don't know what it's been like for you, but for me, it's been a case, if you're trying to watch stuff online, of course, everybody's now out in the UK, and imagine a lot of places around the world, a lot of people are working from home, etc. Mm. So it's putting more stress on the internet provider services and mobile phone service. So when you start watching something, you sort of get to a bit where it's like, oh, a bit of tension, and then of course it buffers for like 5 minutes. You're like, oh, that ruined that bit there.
It's 1999 again.
And apparently, I don't know if you've seen this in the news today, Netflix went down all across the world.
Oh,
because the amount of people that were trying to stream stuff. And I thought, bloody hell. Yeah,
that
massive service like that, you know, got all the power and whatever else behind it, and even they went down, so...
Yeah, it's well, which makes sense, because I think the current figures are 25% of the world is on lockdown.
Yes.
So there you go. What else is there to do? Well,
Well, there you go.
Have a chat. No, that's gone. Ah, what's on Netflix? Well, of course, those people that have prodigious collections of physical media are chuckling away at their prescient behavior of collecting movies they never thought they'd live long enough to watch. Now there's time.
Yep. So, have you watched anything else?
I watched Direct to Video, which is...
oh, yeah, that was something else. I think there's something else I watched, but what was it? But yes, I'll let you take the lead on this one, but I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, I really enjoy this. It's lovely. And is it Dustin Ferguson?
Ferguson, yeah.
Oh, phew. Yeah, he's the guy that made it. It's Direct to Video. I think the subtitle is something like 90s horror movies, or forgive it, I can't remember, but it's really fun. All you need to know is it's just that. So it's a documentary about an hour and 45 minutes long, mm-hmm. about 90 straight to video horror. And it starts off with a lot of really fun detail about Charles Band and Full Moon Pictures. It wanders off into some really entertaining stuff about Fred Olen Ray making what's the guy's name? Jim Wynorski making Sorority House Massacre 2. And it's just and they got an amazing amount of people, including a couple of people that appear to have had a significant amount of cosmetic surgery and look a bit terrifying.
Think about Deborah Dutch.
Deborah Dutch, that's the one. Why? I didn't know where to look and I was scared to look anywhere. But it's very affectionate, and it threw up, maybe not the right choice of words, but it threw up a couple of movies that I realized I'd never watched. Like I never watched Pinocchio's Revenge. But I was a big fan of Kevin S. Tenney's things like Witchboard 2, and he did Night of the Demons, and I think he came back for the sequels. But yeah, there was a couple of titles that just never came to the video shop in that period, so I never was able to watch them. But a lot of others that I remember really enjoying, like Night of the Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. It's just a really entertaining breeze through this period that, for me, so I was a teenager in the 90s, so I was getting this stuff from the video shop whenever I could, and this is so much about the films I was watching. Troma, Lloyd Kaufman's in there, of course. But they rounded up a whole bunch of people. Kelly Maroney's in there from Chopping Mall. Mm-hmm. It's just a really impressive, for obviously a very low budget documentary, but it's an impressive bunch of talking heads. And as much fun as anything is the trailers that are used to, they couldn't afford the proper clips, but they've got a bunch of trailers to illustrate the films in question. The trailers are as much fun as anything. So direct to video is great.
Yes, I really liked it. You can watch it if you want to watch it. I believe you can watch it on SoCal Productions website. But yeah, it has, as Stephen mentioned, it's all about 90s direct-to-video stuff. But I was watching it and I was like, I remember that. I remember the, you know, stuff coming out for it. Or and then the one that you mentioned was the one that's that I've seen that, but such a long time ago and I forgot it. And it was Pinocchio's Revenge. And who else was turned up? There was Dolly Dearest turned up as well. That's the only thing that came up.
Oh, yeah, Dolly Dearest. Yeah, because the FX guy is interviewed with the Dolly behind him, isn't he?
Yes. But, yeah, it was... It's definitely worth watching. SoCal Studios, I think that's the place anyway. Yeah. But they have a online streaming thing you can watch stuff on. If I can remember what it is later, I will let you know. But yes. And anything else?
I think that's probably it. I watched VFW. I think that was this month. I've lost all track of time and space. But if you haven't seen VFW, you obviously need to go and watch it right now, which is Joe Begos's kind of a tribute to Assault on Precinct 13, really, about a bunch of old Vietnam War veterans gathered in a bar and they're assaulted by a bunch of punks. And it has outrageous gore and amazing cast, Fred Williamson and William Sadler. Just tremendous. VFW was probably the most entertaining film I watched this month.
That's did you say it had Fred Williamson in it?
Yeah, it's a whole bunch of veterans. Fred Williamson, William Sadler, Stephen Lang, he's all the right, lead. Yeah. Martin Coe from the Karate Kid films, he's got a big role in it. And Norm from Cheers, George Wendt, which is bizarre.
That's a bit of an odd one to throw in there, but there we go.
Joe Begos has been making really good films. Well, he's been making films for a while, which all have this 80s vibe and all have these great electronic soundtracks. And there's never been one that's made me go, wow, but all of them have been films that made me go, this guy's obviously really good, but he hasn't yet made the film that made me go, wow. But VFW is that film. So he's lived up to the promise from things like, I've already forgotten what they're called, but he's made a bunch of films. Bliss was the most recent one.
Yes.
And
Almost Human.
Almost Human, which has got some really good moments. And is it The Mind's Eye? I think was the one after that.
Is it A Mind's Eye or The
Mind's Eye. But all those films have great moments, but they don't quite hang together. But this is the one that really does hang together, and you're like, yes, this is the guy that we wanted to deliver this movie all along. And I think it's been playing really well. I'm sure it played at Glasgow Fright Fest here, and it's destined to be one of those films that people talk about and does really well on streaming and stuff.
Well, you mentioned it to me, and I was like, did I watch the trailer? Yeah, this definitely something like that. So much so, I haven't even watched it. I just put it straight down for my, you know, to buy it as soon as it came out. So I think it is come out now, hasn't it? I think it's come out in this country.
You're pretty sure, yeah. It's out there on streaming for sure.
Yeah.
But I guess, yeah.
So, yeah, I just decided, why not? It looks like one of those sort of films I'm going to be enjoying. And just going back to direct-to-video, that website I was trying to remember was, so it's a bit long-winded, so it's SoCal Cinema Studio On Demand, number 5 at the end of it, .vhx.tv. Just search SoCal Cinema Studios On Demand and you will find it. And I believe it's on there. If not, it's probably on Amazon and places like that, I would have thought.
Yeah.
I'd imagine.
There's a few documentaries kind of for that nostalgic thing about 80s and 90s movies, but this is probably the best one I've seen, certainly for a while. And just because it's got a great bunch of people and they're all quite funny and entertaining talking about the period.
Well, the thing is now is you're having, this is why you have a lot of this 80s nostalgia type stuff, is everybody that was growing up in the 80s, 90s, whatever, can now go out and make films because they're old enough to do that sort of thing. So,
yeah,
of course, you have all that sort of people going, oh, I want to throw a bit of what I grew up on into my movie. So I'm really not looking forward to films in, I don't know, 2030, 2040, when people start showing things that happened in, oh, I want stuff, make stuff that was inspiring me in the early 2000s. Oh, God.
Oh, shiza. Yeah, yeah. What will happen?
Yeah, exactly. What will happen? It'd be a lot of people probably pretending that they're, I don't know, 2000 version of yuppies.
Oh,
yeah. Of course, you have the 90s people as well making stuff.
Oh,
but hey, God. There you go. But yeah, in regards to direct video, I think it's out there anyway somewhere. If not, it probably will come out. But put it on your list if you want to watch it. And like, I know all these films that actually we mentioned, I would say give them a watch. Who knows? We might turn you on to something different. So, Stephen.
Yes.
I don't know if you've read the news today, but somebody, quite a big name in the horror industry, passed away.
Yes. And died.
Yep. Do you know who it was?
Yes. Yes, unfortunately. Another one has left us, whatever that means. Left us? Well, passed away. Yeah, Stuart Gordon died today. And he was really, really good. I actually have his autograph. I wrote to him, like, I was in a period of time when I was writing to people. Quite lonely, obviously. And usually, you know, you'd wait ages and nobody would write back. Or you'd get the occasional signed photo that you think, ah, this was probably just your wife signed this. But Stuart Gordon actually made the effort. It must have been like the late, I was trying to work out earlier when it was, but it must have been the late 2000-ish, 2007-ish, because he sent across like a Masters of Horror card that was signed, because he just made an episode from that.
That's what I was about to say. It must have been about that.
And he signed his photograph on his big bald head with a nice personalization. He wrote a separate letter as well, which no one did that, apart from a few of like the Hammer Horror ladies and things like that. But yeah, he was great. He died and he had an amazing amount of good films that he made. Most famously, Reanimator, The Head Giving Head, which everybody loves. But also really weird stuff like From Beyond, Castle Freak. We were talking earlier about Robot Jocks. He wrote Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So, you know, he made some money along the way with Disney. And later on, he branched off into other stuff like Edmund and King of the Ants and Stuck, which is the movie where Mira Savino drives home with a dead bloke stuck in a windscreen. So And he worked with loads of cool people like David Mamet and George Wendt, who we just mentioned.
Jeffrey Koons, who's usually in the majority of his films, I think.
Yeah, and actually, I do think, you know, people tended to, not that much, but they tended to poo-poo some of Masters of Horror, but Stuart Gordon's episodes in particular were awesome because there's the Black Cat episode with Jeffrey Koons as Poe, Dreams in the Witch House, which is probably one of the best Lovecraftian adaptation type things. So, he did some amazing stuff. And he was a really kind of funny, intelligent bloke to watch in an interview. So, yeah, it's a real shame.
Yes, so he's now passed, and there isn't really many left of what I would consider, I don't know, our generation of horror directors growing up on, you know. So in your teenage age, you had obviously Stuart Gordon and people like that. What's there? Brian Usner? He's still around, I believe.
He's good, yeah. Yeah, he's Cronenberg's still around.
Yeah.
In this time of pandemic, can I just check, has anyone checked on John Carpenter?
Oh, he's probably fine.
Oh, yeah. He always stays in anyway. He's a shut-in.
He's going to be like, what's the guy in Rolling Stones that's always...
Keith Richards.
Yeah, he's going to be like him. There'll be cockroaches still around, and John Carpenter and Keith Richards.
I hope so. Because he's not in danger of the pandemic, hopefully, because he stays in watching wrestling and getting stoned.
Yeah.
And doing the next Halloween sequel in his kitchen, the score. Yeah, oh, that's okay. That reassures me, actually.
So, as we mentioned, Stuart Gordon, we're not going to talk about him in depth today, but we thought, just in case you've missed the news, we'll let you know about that. But in the future, Stephen, we will do an episode talking about Mr. Gordon, specifically one of his films, I would have thought, but... we won't say what that is for now. Just look towards the future.
Oh, yeah.
And talking of people that died.
Oh.
So Stuart Gordon died 1 year and 1 day after Larry Cohen, who we're going to be talking about a bit later on in this podcast. But the film we're going to be talking about is, for Retro Rewind, is The Stuff.
One lick is never enough of The Stuff,
which is a great movie. I don't care what anybody says.
It's fantastic.
It's I don't know what your favorite Larry Cohen movie is, but mine has always been The Stuff.
It's high up there. I don't know if I can pick one, but The Stuff's probably the one I think it is the one I've watched the most. Maybe Q as well. Yeah, The Stuff was a video favorite for sure.
So do you want to give a brief rundown to people, let them know what The Stuff is about if they haven't seen it? And if not, why not?
Why not? Yeah, exactly. Why? Heathens, the lot of them.
Exactly. It's only been around for 35 years. It's not like you haven't got any time to watch it.
And now you've got more time than you ever imagined. Because for most of you, work is all over. Your company has either disappeared or your job has vanished or it's just been put on hold for a very long, indeterminate period of time.
Yes.
Don't trust your neighbour. They're probably carrying it. Just stay indoors. Go out into your garden now and again, possibly for some exercise for no more than an hour, and then come back inside. Kiss your loved ones goodnight. Actually, don't. Just elbow rub them.
Yes.
Because they're probably carriers too. Trust no one.
Trust no one.
Especially them. Yeah, The Stuff was made in 1985.
Yeah.
Same. So The Stuff, The stuff was inspired by Larry Cohen, was a madman, and he always, but a great one. And he was inspired, from what I can gather, by, you know, by the fact that corporations got away with murder for decades with dangerous products that the government just rubber stamped. Oh, yeah, that'll be all right. Including Coca-Cola famously having small bits of cocaine back in the 1920s. Yep. So he was inspired by that. He was inspired by adverts for medications and all those disclaimers on the medications you take every morning for your high blood pressure about what, fatal side effects. May contain death. What the fuck?
You have to have somebody, you know, it's speed running across the bottom of the advert. So reading all out, you're like, the hell?
Week. What was that?
Oh, okay.
It's brilliant.
Well, yeah. It's been FDA stamped, so it must be true.
Well, it's fine then. And what's been present in his films anyway, as we'll probably move on to later in things like It's Alive, is also the background of the stuff, the fact that, you know, we've polluted the earth, so the earth maybe might start to bite back. I mean, not that that's happening right now in the world, of course. And behind the stuff as well is things like The Blob and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Invaders from Mars. All of this stuff is in the background of the stuff. And it starts with some old bloke who finds the stuff in some snow. It's bubbling straight out of the ground. Immediately his thought is, I can sell this on and make some cash.
Well, actually, his immediate thought is, there's some strange bubbling hot stuff diggling out of the ground. I'll just stick my finger in it and eat it.
Which is like all those scenes in films where people somewhere where something gory has happened see some blood and just put their finger in it, taste it. Oh, it's definitely blood. Yeah,
it's definitely blood. Yeah, so it's not corn syrup. Yeah.
And your protagonist in all of this, in a way, I suppose, before Michael Moriarty shows up, your protagonist is this little kid who, like the kid in things like Invaders from Mars, is aware that his parents are weird and acting moody because they're addicted to this dessert sensation.
Called
which,
the stuff.
Is low in calories, good taste, and doesn't even spot.
Artificial chemicals.
So his parents are talking like adverts because they're addicted to it. It's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. There's the bit that I always love is a line there where the woman turns to his mum and he says, why are you eating it? And she goes, it's low in calories. I've lost so many, you know, pounds or whatever. And he goes, why are you talking like an advert?
It's just brilliant. And the film is punctuated. The film all the way through has these, you know, these ridiculous adverts using, in fact, some of the people that work with Larry Cohen all the time in the guest spots, these convincingly horrible TV ads for it. And it becomes this thing, this sensation across the nation. And it's all based on a secret formula that no one's wanting to talk about, a bit like the Colonel's secret ingredient in KFC, of course, which is presumably jizz and something else.
It's chicken, yeah. Stephen. The secret ingredient is chicken.
Say what?
The secret ingredient is chicken.
Oh.
They didn't hide it very well. They put it in the sun.
Wow. Oh, okay. Well,
the more you know. Breaking news.
At least we know. At least we know it is no calories, it's natural, no artificial additives, eat as much as you like. And basically Michael Moriarty is Mo.
No, well, he's David Mo Rutherford. His actual name's David, but he always likes to be known as Mo.
And he's an industrial spy that's hired by the company to hunt out the ingredients of the stuff. And I'm right, he's got a different toupee in each film because he's not a man with loads of hair, right, Michael Moriarty?
No, Q, which was, I think, previous to this.
Yeah, 82.
There isn't a lot of, he ain't got a lot of hair in that, really, but this one he seems to have more hair.
He's so blossomed.
Yes, been out in the sun.
Michael, it's brilliant. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about toupees and stuff, and I like the idea. I've always enjoyed wearing wigs, and Michael Moriarty is a personal hero, so I'll carry on thinking about it. But yeah, Michael Moriarty turns up in this meeting, and he goes around the room.
Basically... Oh, sweaty palm. Oh, sweaty... Never sweaty palm.
Michael Moriarty, I was watching some of the background stuff with this, and Larry Cohen made 5 movies with Michael Moriarty. The last one was the Masters of Horror episode.
Yes.
And he basically saw them both. He saw a lot in common with Michael Moriarty to himself. They're both like what he described as jazz performers. So all that means really is that they're both a bit batshit mad. And they both had this musical jazz thing where they just make stuff up. So much of the stuff is the film going off on tangents because they're just improvising the whole thing. And that's partly, I think, what makes it so much fun.
Yes. And I've always liked Michael Moriarty. He's a bit like Bill Oberst Jr. He's an actor, which if I see him in, I thought, cool, he's in this. Yeah. Just because you know you're about to have a bit of fun. Especially when Michael Moriarty turns up in a film.
Definitely.
Even if it's just for, a 5-minute bit, but it's that bit you tend to remember in a film.
Yeah.
But yes, in this, he is Moe Rutherford, as Stephen said, the industrial spy hired to take down, well, not take down, it's really to find out what's inside the stuff. But as we know, Stephen, the stuff, you could just never get enough.
Oh, one lick is certainly never enough of the stuff.
It is addictive, though, and it is destructive.
Mm-hmm.
It can overcome your mind and take over your body.
One thing I want to know is...
And nothing can stop it.
Oh, shit. Oh, Pete's been taken over. Great.
The stuff!
First coronavirus, now the dessert. Hey, why do they call him Mo? I'm curious to know.
What, you want to know why he's called Mo?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. They said to find that when he's asked, when people want to pay him something, he always asks for Mo. Mo money.
What I like, he goes to this meeting, the sweaty palm meeting. He turns
sweaty palm.
All twitchy. and he just punches the guy in the face as a kind of parting shot. Well, I'll be off now.
Well, it's because he was being cheeky to him earlier because he used to be a former FBI person as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he's ex-FBI, yeah.
And the other guy was like, yeah, you got kicked out of the FBI. And he's like, well, goodbye to everybody and smack in the face to you. Yes. But, yeah, it's an entertaining film. And as it ultimately goes through, you have Michael Moriarty's character who meets up with, I can't remember her name is at the moment, but...
I've forgotten as well.
Andrea Marcovici? That sounds...
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she makes television adverts. So basically, she was the woman who created all the whole marketing scheme for the stuff. And so really, it's her fault. If it's going to be anybody's fault, it's really hers because she's the one that marketed it out to everybody. And of course, he starts a bit of a love interest with her, but really he's getting in with her to obviously take down this company, which you later find out is not totally legit, Stephen. It's not actually made in a factory. Did you know?
What?
It's actually coming from the ground.
Just like Coca-Cola.
Yes. And it's finger-licking good.
It's brilliant. And yeah, I like the fact, because Michael Moriarty, because they do have this kind of romance, although the big kind of what presumably would usually be the sex scene ends with him getting this stuff over his face like he's from Alien, her setting fire to his face. Because Michael Moriarty is not someone you can usually imagine having sex.
Well, it's not somebody I would normally imagine having sex, but hey, everybody has their own thing.
Tom Atkins is obviously total man whore.
He's a stud. Just look at Halloween 3. Yeah,
Can I see some ID? Oh, forget about it. Let's go.
I shall take these as ID.
That's exactly what he says. Yeah. Yeah, it's siphoned straight out of the earth into trucks and things. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a whole factory that's devoted to obviously packing it up, shipping it everywhere. Presumably, it's actually being shipped all around the world because you don't actually get told that, do you? It's obviously based in America, so I'm presuming it's gone worldwide.
Yeah, and there is the sense of that. It's a phenomena.
So it's as Stephen said, it's blob-ish. It's basically that kind of thing. And I think I must have watched the same thing that you watched, because I think Kim Newman's in it, and he says this came out right about the same time as, well, a couple of years later, the Blob remake. And when he mentioned it, I was like, actually, he has a point there. I remember more about the stuff than I do about the Blob remake.
Yeah, the Blob remake is really good, but it's quite straightforward, isn't it? It's just whereas the stuff is more, well, it's literally them making it up as they go along, from, and that's how it feels, and that's how the documentary suggests it was to some extent. This is a bit more a bunch of people got together and behaved a bit badly and got away with it. And the Blob remake is the big studio thing where it's like, yeah, but it's also informed by the kind of Dawn of the Dead style satire stuff on consumerism, which is,
well, obviously main focus is about consumerism, because this would have been, well, 80s, so what you'd have, well, see, Coca-Cola and Pepsi you wore then, wouldn't you? That was the main sort of thing back then. So yeah, you'd have that, and of course television adverts would start kicking, MTV and all that type of thing, trying focusing more advertisement on the kids or whatever. So this is basically that taken to the next extreme. What can you sell to somebody if you have a fancy jingle and a fancy advert? What can you sell to people?
Well, there is that scene, isn't there, where the kid, the only kid that knows exactly what the stuff is and what it's capable of, he sabotages the display at the supermarket.
He
goes mental. and the kids are all scrambling because he knocks it over, and the other kids are all scrambling to just literally lick it up from the floor, the dirty bastards. And it's no coincidence that when they blow the stuff restaurant up at the end, it's right next to a McDonald's.
Yes.
Larry Cohen was not, it was totally brazen about who his targets were, and rightly so. And they find Chocolate Chip Charlie, and he said, oh, sure as hell ain't the Kentucky Colonel. So the whole thing is a massive takedown of the stuff that Larry Cohen found awful.
And probably rightfully so in a lot of people's eyes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, it's not a straight, as Stephen said, it's not a straight horror sci-fi. It has comedy elements in it. I'd imagine if you took out the comedy elements, I don't know if the film would work as well.
Yeah, and that was covered, isn't it, in either the commentary or the documentary, which was that he was given freedom to make the film he wanted to, but the studio clearly expected a more traditional Blob sort of horror film.
We want a monster movie.
And then when he turned up with it, it was obviously more of a comedy, and they felt it wasn't horrific enough, but it was too late because he'd already made it. So they expected some kind of serious-ish horror film, but actually there's not a lot of true horror in it, apart from the cool effects of people's faces being stoned.
Oh, the special effects in this are great.
They're really fun. Obviously,
compared to a lot of people would probably watch it now, you have like the blue screen type stuff, and you're kind of, are they standing in front of a blue screen kind of stuff? But other than that, I would say the special effects in this are actually better than a lot of films you tend to see now, as in the practical effects.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and there's some great stuff in it.
I personally wouldn't want, if they said, oh, we're going to remake the stuff or something like that, I'd think, well, you know how they're going to remake it. You know it's definitely going to be CGI. I don't know if I want that. I'd want it to be, if they was to ever do a remake, which I can't see happening, but if they did, I'd want it to be practical effects.
Yeah.
And did you?
Absolutely.
Would you have ever, well, I'll actually listen in a minute after we've gone a bit further down with the film. So obviously, my brother's character and the lady that he's with and the young boy now go off to the factory, or the mine, really, where they first come across the stuff. And to, well, blow up the factory, don't they? They blow up the factory, they blow up all where it's all coming out, because it's a bit like the Blob in terms of it's afraid of, well, it not afraid, but it could be put down with something. In this case, for the stuff, it appears to be fire is the thing that can make it go away, which is kind of funny considering, you know, the stuff's coming out of the ground where the center of the earth is very, very hot. But there we go. So there's that, and of course they do what they have to do to take down the industry by coming together with this. I'm guessing he must have been a ex-colonel of some sort who maybe got discredited from the army for some reason.
He's brilliant.
And yeah, that's when majority of the comedy elements come in, is when poor Savino, that's his name, isn't it?
He's fantastic. Yeah, absolutely.
He comes in, and of course, he owns his own radio station and all this kind of thing. And they put out a big old, you know, distress warning to say, stop eating the stuff, stop buying it, it's dangerous, blah, blah, blah. Then, of course, you have the bit, you know, like Nazi Germany, instead of books being burnt in the streets, it's just tubs of the stuff being burnt in piles and stuff like that. But then you get towards the end where you think everything's A-OK. But it's not. Because, like a lot of things, where you think it's going to be got rid of, some people hoard those sort of things. So they know they can make money from it. So it ends with a bunch of people, a bit like, you know, a bit twitchy because they can't get their fix of whatever. But this, in this case, it's people that can't get their fix of the stuff. So they're buying it on the, you know, the black market out on the streets, probably paying X amount of money for their fix of the stuff, which a company, which is, you know, happens all the time. So instead of it just being called the stuff, their original plan was to resell it as something else called the taste.
Oh, the taste. That's so, very different.
Yes, exactly the same font and everything on the packaging, but this is called the taste. But yeah, I did. I've always liked this film. It's always been one of my personal favourites of Larry Cohen's. Yeah. And any of these as a blob-esque type movies, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got so much. It's so much packed into however long it is. It's very short, but an hour and a half.
An hour and a half.
Into it, isn't it? And I think, as we'll probably talk about in a minute, but Larry Cohen's stuff was packed full of things. And even the cast is great. You mentioned Paul Savino. I mean, Danny Aiello is in there as well. He's part of the team that tested and approved the stuff. He turns up with it. He feeds the stuff to his dog, and the dog is one of the great special effects in the film, where the dog goes completely mental. This mad puppet dog.
Yes.
I've already forgotten the guy that plays. I've forgotten the name of the guy that plays. Oh, is it Garrett Morris? Plays Chocolate Chip Charlie.
Yes.
His hands are registered as lethal weapons. he lost his company because of the stuff. They, you know, they stole his whole company away, and he's great. And he has that famous moment where his mouth opens to a massive degree and the stuff erupts out of it, which is still a really fun practical effect, which, as Pete said, would never work as a CGI effect because it would date after about 3 months and look like garbage. James Dixon is the guy that works at the post office. James Dixon is in all three It's Alive films, and it was always part of Larry Cohen's kind of repertory crew of people that he always relied on to cast in his movies. And Paul Savino is totally mad in the Apocalypse Now type stuff, where he's this mad colonel in the castle who rants about commies and says, oh, we never lost a war. Oh, hang on, what about Vietnam? Stop with your liberal remarks. he's great.
We lost that war at home.
Yeah, that's it, that's the line. So Larry Cohen, Patrick Neal's in there as well. He's like the distributor guy.
Yes.
But Larry Cohen was always able to, because he was such a charismatic, confident figure, he was always able to round up a bunch of quite prominent character actors to be in his films. And they obviously enjoyed getting the attention and getting the roles in this stuff. The final bit, the kind of key bit where they do the warning about, you know, if the stuff is in your house, do not eat it. The warning broadcast is very much in the tradition of things like The Thing from Another World, the keep watching the skies. So the movie is very 80s in its look, in its special effects, and in its consumerist message, but it's also based around that 50s paranoia of there's something out there coming from the earth or coming from the skies that will get you in the end, whether it's communists or the blob. It's a nice combination, I think, of two very different eras of horror films and sci-fi films. And that's why it's so much fun.
So here's the question I was going to put towards you. So I mentioned I wouldn't want to see a remake. I don't think it would suit. I mean, obviously the consumerism message would still suit now, but I don't think using CGI or anything like that would really work as well. But the question I was going to ask you is, would you have liked to have seen a sequel?
Actually, yes, I think, because if it's based around how good the It's Alive sequels are, and actually how good Maniac Cop 2 is, which he wrote, didn't direct, but he wrote it. Maniac Cop 3 we can talk about later. But yeah, I think I would. As long as he was involved, I think he's the key factor in this. The whole film is very Larry Cohen-y. And in fact, every, I've not seen all of them, but everything he directed that I've seen is very much a film made by that bloke. I would like to have seen a sequel to this stuff. I think if anybody could do it well, he could, based again on the sequels he did make and the consistency of the stuff he made. The stuff. Because it is the stuff.
But yeah, overall, if I was to review it, I would give it 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
Star rating, which I think is a fair rating.
It's just
so weird. Just to end this thing, unless you want to say anything else about the stuff.
I think that's it. I do think it holds up really well. There's not that many films being made now that are so distinctive. And so where you can watch it and go, yeah, this is a film totally made by Larry Cohen. It's not made by a committee or by a studio. He came along, he got the funding. They probably wanted something very different, but he thought, fuck it, and he did it anyway. He did it his way. He got away with it for about 40 years. And watching it now, it's probably even better than it ever was, because probably when I watched it in the 80s, I just enjoyed the dog and everything else. But now watching it, I go, yeah, this is even more relevant now that we're all consumerist slaves to this rubbish.
So I watched it on the Arrow Blu-ray that came out
five
years ago, maybe later than that. I think it's out probably on Amazon and all those sort of places. So definitely put the stuff on your watch list if you haven't seen it. But I personally say, if you like The Blob, those kind of things, or you like anything by Larry Cohen, just go out and buy it. But we're going to end this, Stephen, this bit. Mm. I don't know if you remember the poster. It's the specific poster for the stuff, which has a big red warning sign on the top of it with a man's mouth stretched open and gunk pouring out of his eyes and his mouth.
Hmm.
So we're going to end with the text that's on the... It says, on the poster, it says, "Warning, if you see the stuff in stores, call the police. If you have it in your home, don't touch it. Get out. The stuff is a product of nature, a deadly living organism. It is addictive and destructive. It can overcome your mind and take over your body, and nothing can stop it."
It's great. Just great.
Yeah, I think it's a good poster. Oh, Stephen's got it.
Yep, that's it. I'm all over. Yeah, it's great, and it is. It's very much of that period of the old 80s VHS things. And it was also, because it wasn't massively nasty, it was something that would turn up on TV quite a bit as well.
That's where I first saw it. It was maybe on BBC One, maybe.
Yeah.
Remember watching it. Yeah, you know, this is the time when you'd be watching stuff and you'd be like watching, 1950s B movies on BBC Two where it had a double bill or something.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're like, oh, this is on late night, 9 o'clock. You watch it.
Yeah, it's one of those. And few of his were like that. A few of his did the rounds on TV, so they were quite accessible.
And so they should be.
Oh, yeah.
So that's everything, really, about the stuff. Just basically go out and buy it. I know I just gave you that warning, but go out and buy the stuff.
Yeah.
Ignore the warning I just given you. Go out and buy the stuff.
And actually, when you watch it, you realise, or at least I realise, that, yeah, I'd be one of those people buying the stuff. It looks really tasty. No calories, doesn't spot. Yeah.
I don't know if I would be. I think I'd be more, sure on this. I'd be like looking at it again. It doesn't actually say what's in it. I think I'll wait for a bit.
Oh, man.
And then I'd be like that kid and Michael Moriarty. It's coming up to you and going, "Hey, Steve, you've got a sweaty palm.
He's brilliant. He's truly great. And as far as I know, I've forgotten what show he was in. Some big American show where he either got an Emmy award.
No Order, wasn't it?
Well, maybe, yeah, probably. I can't remember. But he was in something where I remember finding out that he'd got a lot of attention for it. And I was like, yes, that's the star of the stuff, that he's actually being respected at last.
And Moriarty.
He's a really good actor. And I guess these films where Larry Cohen called him up and said, are you free on Friday to blah, 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 was great fun for him because he got a chance to just do his own thing. And there's nobody quite like him in 80s horror for sure.
No. So I suppose, odds of luck, yeah, it's Law and Order he was in.
Yes.
Just bought a better check, and he's still around, so
yeah,
it still looks the same ish
he's one of those people.
Yeah. So I guess then, Stephen, as we just spoken about the stuff, and we've name dropped Larry Cohen just a couple of times, I suppose we might as well talk the rest of Larry Cohen. I suppose the first thing would be, what was the first Larry Cohen film you think you saw?
Ooh, I think, in fact, I'm pretty sure it was probably Cue the Winged Serpent.
The Winged Serpent.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure this was on BBC. I know it was on Moviedrome, presented by Alex Cox, which was this Sunday night, I think it was Sunday night. Usually a double bill of films that were considered cult films that this very entertaining chap called Alex Cox would host on BBC Two. It was cool because they were on BBC Two. You knew they were going to be uncut, so they wouldn't have all the usual muddy funster overdubbing of swearing and stuff.
Yes.
But Cue the Winged Serpent was one of those, so that may have been the first time I watched it. And that's the first Larry Cohen film I remember. And it's one of the very best. It's way up there. And it also has Michael Moriarty in it.
It is. Is it the first film? I think it is the first film that has Michael Moriarty in working with Larry Cohen.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you mentioned, I'll say my first Larry Cohen film was The Stuff, which we've just mentioned anyway. So we won't talk about that too much. But I suppose the next one for me would be Cue the Winged Serpent, which also stars David Carradine.
Yes.
Which I don't know if you've ever, I watched the audio commentary on it recently for the sake of this episode. And Larry Cohen goes in depth about obviously the film, etc. And he mentions how he got David Carradine involved in the film. And the story goes that he bumps into him at some festival somewhere. And he's like, if I get space in one of my films sometime, I'll give you a call. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the film, started filming it with Michael Moriarty doing the song in the bar. when David Carradine first bumps into him. And that was the first scene that David Carradine had done in the film. He didn't know, he hadn't even read the script. He literally came in, knew what line he had to do for that scene, and he was so nervous, he went in there, did the thing, and as soon as the camera stopped rolling, he went outside and puked.
Wow.
It's like, that's David Carradine. Be like hearing Chuck Norris's, you know, just hurt his hand. hurt his hand and he wanted a plaster.
The old softy.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. And he's really good in it. And it's a great New York film.
Oh, yeah.
Q is. And as you said, there's loads of great stories about how it came to be. But one was the fact that Larry Cohen had got fired from a big studio thing called I, the Jury.
Yes.
And so and this becomes a big part of the plot of Special Effects, which is a film he made after Q. But he shot Q the Winged Serpent in 18 days, and he shot it kind of guerrilla style on the streets of New York with no permits or anything like that. And Phone Booth is quite interesting. Many years later, not directed by Larry Cohen, but Phone Booth was kind of shot again on the streets of the city with questionable permissions to do so. But yeah, Q is fantastic. David Carradine's great. He's the detective in the story. Moriarty is hilarious as the kind of ex-con.
He's a very jittery ex-con who's trying to make things better for himself and his partner, but of course, who wants to hire an ex-con? So of course, he ends up obviously slipping back up and going into questionable work.
That's right, yeah. And it's very Moriarty Cohen-y character because he's like a nervous eater. He's scared of everything. Mm-hmm. He's got a big grin on his face for most of the film for no real reason. Shit's going, like in the stuff, all this bad stuff's going down around him, but he's just making rubbish jokes.
Just that you mentioned rubbish jokes, one that popped in my head from the stuff is when they steal the truck with the stuff in it. And the hose is leaking out on the back of the lorry when it gets pulled over by the police officer. And the police officer pulls Moriarty over and he goes, "What seems to be the problem, officer?" And he says, "Your hose is dangling out." And he says something on the lines of, are you going to do me for indecent exposure?" I just thought it was funny. So.
It's great in his delivery. Yeah, he's fair, and he's a hero of Q in a ridiculous way because he's a bit of an idiot, and he's a failed kind of singer pianist, but he becomes the most important person in New York City because he knows where the Winged Serpent is hidden in the Chrysler Building. He's asking for $1 million from the mayor, and he's ranting about. He demands to see Rupert Murdoch. And it's just great. It's all structured around his kind of slightly manic performance. While there's all these detectives and cops on the crime scenes making bad jokes about, maybe her head just fell off. It got loose. While the serpent is biting the heads off window cleaners and sunbathers and stuff. So I think it's one of the great New York horror films. It's like the stuff, it feels like it was mostly made up as they went along, but that's part of its charm.
Well, on the audio commentary, Larry Cohen goes in a bit more depth about it, and he says, thing with the jury, he got fired from that, and I think it's called the Mayfair Hotel. That's the one that all the cast and crew was in for that show. So he got fired. Obviously, he has to leave the hotel, which the whole production company was renting for the sake of it, and he got fired, got kicked out of the job, and obviously went out, and then a couple of days later he came back in, obviously a brand new script, which is Cue the Winged Serpent, and he comes in with a whole production crew and David Carradine, and he's like, "Oh," and he bumps into one of the people that was on the jury film, "Why are you here?" And he's like, "I've got a film." And I thought, yeah, that would be one of them. Yeah, F you. You got rid of me. I'm going to do things my way now. But he goes in depth about the film is basically, he describes it as, it's a monster movie in that sort of Godzilla-esque kind of monster movie type thing. But it's also to deal with, as in Michael Moriarty's character, is that whole aspect of people want something for nothing. So it's that whole, in the aspect of that time period, and probably a lot more now, is people suing people just for the sake of it, in the chance of, oh, I'll get something out of it. Oh, I'll give you this bit of information, which in Michael Molinaro's character cases, I'll tell you the location of this giant bird type thing that's killing people, but I won't do it unless you give me a good £1 million and I get a pardon and all this kind of stuff. So
yeah.
So he has a lot of messages in a lot of his films.
Massively, yeah.
But yeah, so Cue the Winged Serpent, I quite enjoy.
It's great. It has some great, which was petering out in the 80s, but it has some great stop motion animation as well.
Yes. Well, it has stop motion animation, and it has some practical effects in it as well, because there's I don't know if you recall, there's a giant claw that comes down, picks up a guy in the swimming pool on top of the building.
Yeah,
they built a giant claw specifically for that scene. And I think Richard Roundtree's character gets taken away as well.
Yes. Oh, Richard Roundtree. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Shaft, as most people would know him.
It's brilliant. And that's the, and of course, although I've shamefully I've not seen his Larry Cohen's blaxploitation films, but his earlier stuff and later on Original Gangsters was Larry Cohen's dabbling with blaxploitation.
Yeah. So you would be referring to Godfather of Harlem?
Yeah, and what's the Bone? Is it Bone? What was the?
I wanted to say Black Caesar, but that doesn't sound right.
Black Caesar. That sounds, maybe it's an alternate title. I know Bone was one title for one of those pre-It's Alive blaxploitation films he did.
But yes, so he did do a couple. So yeah, I think one of them was called Godfather of Harlem.
Yeah. I'm pretty
sounds
sure.
Vaguely familiar, but yes, but surprisingly, he's one of them directors that obviously did a lot of writing and all this kind of thing. But if you looked at his filmography and seen how many films he's directed, you're like, oh, he didn't direct as many films as I thought he did.
Yeah,
and obviously, he has a mixture of things in his career, from sci-fi, horror, our kind of things, and more sort of thriller type stuff, so Phone Booth and things like that, and a few TV movies, sequels. There's a few sequels in his filmography, most notably the It's Alive sequels, which we shall talk about now, Stephen. Actually, we're talking about It's Alive.
Yeah, those are great movies. There's three of them, in fact. And
yes.
And It's Alive is interesting because it came out in the 1974, I think.
Yes.
And it has a very Rosemary's Baby type poster with this pram where this clawish hand is poking out. And so you expect a film that's just going to be this sort of crazy horror film about a killer baby. And actually, you don't, I mean, presumably because of issues of how to stage it and special effects and limited money, that you hardly ever see the killer baby in It's Alive. You see like baby point of view shots, which are good fun. And you see a couple of glimpses of kind of gnashing teeth and things like that. But you probably get a few seconds of monster baby action, because I don't think that stuff really interested Cohen anyway. I think it was all about the other themes. It's called It's Alive. So that's a famous line from Frankenstein. And there's a scene where the dad, who is John P. Ryan, who's really good in the film, he talks actually about in the film about how as a kid he thought that Karloff was the monster, but actually when he read the book he realized the true monster was the scientist, was the Dr. Frankenstein. But packed into the film, the first It's Alive, but also the sequels, is loads of other themes. Like there's a scene before the massive baby is born with a gigantic head and weighing about 11 pounds. Crawl the hell and eats his way through his own umbilical cord and kills off all the midwives and stuff. But there's a scene with the dads. It's a very good film about the terror of thinking, oh shit, I'm going to be a dad. Oh, what if everything goes wrong? What if she doesn't survive the birth? There's a great scene with the parents or the dads in the waiting room where they're talking about pollution and all the lead that's been found in coffee and the sprays that they're using to get rid of rats, but they're actually creating tougher rats.
Yes.
So It's a really environmentally conscious early 70s film, like so many of Coen's films, and The Stuff is part of that as well. But it's very much a film of its time, where these dads, before the monster baby is born, are talking about the real themes of the movie. And in the first, it's alive, and it kind of follows through in the sequels. But this awful thing happens where this nice, actually quite likable couple give birth to a awful monster baby, but they're hounded by the media, and the mum is made to feel awful because they discover that she just made a simple inquiry about abortion 1 month into pregnancy, and she was taking birth control pills before she became pregnant. So there's all this concentration on the other stuff, not just the fact that she's given birth to a chewy, chompy monster. There's a lot of other stuff happening underneath It's Alive, with the occasional break for Milkman being savaged and the things you expect from the poster.
Yeah.
You still get that stuff, but you realize that there's a really smart guy that's making this monster baby movie.
Well, you, as you mentioned, the sequels, I think the third one is the one that's got Michael Moriarty in it, if I remember correctly. I haven't seen it for quite some time, because usually if I'm going to watch a series of films, or if it's a sequel of a film, I tend to generally I fancy watching that sequel of this bunch, but I'll watch the whole lot, over a period of time. So in this case, I would have watched It's the Live trilogy maybe over a week or something. So it's been a while since I watched them. But I think Michael Moriarty is in the third one. And if I recall, isn't the third one the more sort of comedy-esque type one?
It is, yeah. It's the goriest one. And here's my favorite thing. It's the only film which was ever made where you get to see Michael Moriarty working at a shoe shop. He's the dad of one of the monster babies. And
that sounds familiar, yeah.
It's really good, actually. It's got more gore than the others, but it's still just as mental. And there's a lot of underlying stuff about the AIDS paranoia, where people think the monster baby thing is catching, a bit like the idiots in the 80s that thought you could catch AIDS from a toilet seat. It's a bit like that, or just from reading about AIDS. Oh, God, I've got AIDS.
I've got pregnant from shaking his hand.
He touched me. There's a lot of that running through Island of the Alive, which was the third of the It's Alive films, which makes sense because it was made in 1987 when people were still dicks about AIDS. So to speak.
I think that's an interesting way of putting it, but yeah.
It's about AIDS. It's my new show.
Is this going to be on ITV?
It's going to be on, ITV2. It wasn't quite good enough to be on ITV1.
Well, hopefully you get the, a good viewership and, good sponsorship deal. You never know.
Oh, I'm really...
I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, thanks for that.
So I guess it's the last time you're going to be on this podcast.
The money starts drifting through. No, hopefully this is a new beginning for me. I mean, people have still got cash to spend. The country's looking healthy. So I think it's a right time.
I don't think you'll be looking at the world quite right, Stephen.
What do you mean? No, it's like a boom, right? It's not economically sound.
Oh, perfectly.
Yeah, that's good too. I just thought I'd check. Oh, I might just check the news.
Oh.
All right, it's game over then.
Game over. It's game over, man. Game over.
Oh, God, I hope my mum doesn't find all the porn.
Again?
It's still in the wardrobe. Yeah. Right. So It's Alive 3 is fantastic. Although they're all really good. They're all quite interesting. They're all well cast. Frederick Forrest is in the second one and Moriarty is in the third one. And he's the dad of one of the monster babies. So it was always known, I think maybe in number two, you realize that these babies that are being born, they grow really rapidly. So actually by 5 or 6 years in, they're capable of sexual activity and reproducing themselves. And in the third one, Michael Moriarty is actually, it's kind of a roller coaster performance from him. And he's fantastic in it because the first half, he's very emotional. One of his babies, it's gone to court and he has to bring in his baby in a cage to make his case that he demands that the country provides a safe refuge for these babies, of which there's a few of them, the monster babies, a separate island where they can live rather than them being exterminated, essentially, which is what was happening in number two. Mm-hmm. His ex-wife is Karen Black. So again, Larry Cohen has got this amazing cast of people who are actually delivering real performances. Moriarty shags a hooker played by Lorraine Landon, who's in a lot of Larry Cohen films, including Maniac Cop. And the kids are quarantined on this secret island. But of course, it attracts the attention of the media and of pharmaceutical companies. So this satirical stuff is underlying the whole thing. And Michael Moriarty's character is being exploited himself. There's these lost connection with the movie rights. So there's going to be like books about it that he's getting no money from. And he makes a joke about merchandise, but probably that's going to happen as well. So he ends up working in a shoe shop.
Yep, of all places.
Where he has to deal with miserable customers and snotty bastard kids.
Wait, we'll be doing that in this environment.
Yeah. Oh, no snot. No snot allowed. You'd be exterminated. Witch hunt. Yep.
Yes.
Burn them out of town. But in the end, he goes to the island and it's a very, very bizarre Michael Moriarty performance. There's a massacre. He's the only one left in the end and he's steering a boat full of mutant babies who are actually quite grown up because they're about 5 years old. And actually, it becomes a weird... he sings sea shanties. This is your one chance to watch Michael Moriarty working in a shoe shop and singing sea shanties.
Well, there you go. If they haven't been sold by anything else, you've got to be sold by that.
It's also tragic. Oh, it's just brilliant. The It's Alive films really do run that full gamut of emotional stuff you don't expect from a horror film about a mutant baby, and the sarcasm you get when you have Michael Moriarty as your hero. they're fantastic, and they do hold up really well, actually.
If I remember correctly, wasn't it Anchor Bay that put the box set out in the UK?
I think it's Warner Brothers. I think it was always owned by Warners. Yeah. They do have each film has a commentary by Larry Cohen, which I've never listened to, but I think would be really worth listening to, but no other extras. So I'm pretty sure it was still Warners that were putting them out.
Yeah, you might be right. I mean, I have got it, but it's, you know, obviously in an area where I can't get to it at the moment because I'm obviously sitting here. But
well, they're really good films. I know there's a Blu-ray. There's a recent Blu-ray, probably by Scream Factory, that obviously is no good for people like me, but they possibly had a few more extras and they carried over the commentary, but the movies are really worth rewatching.
So is that trilogy of films? And actually, as you just mentioned that, I can see this being put into franchise corners, certainly somewhere along the line.
It's Alive. Yeah.
It would certainly make sense. And just going back to the blaxploitation films, I was correct. It was Black Caesar. But Godfather of Harlem was released theatrically in the UK as Godfather of Harlem, which is funny because I only knew the film as Black Caesar, which is the American title. Mm-hmm. And the other blaxploitation film of his was Hell Up in Harlem, which was the sequel to it. So, which has James Brown did the music to the first, or at least did the title track to Black Caesar. So, yeah, there you go.
Whoa.
But I suppose other things that suit our genre would be things like Full Moon High, which is a comedy.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that for a long time.
I've only seen it once, and I don't remember much about it. I vaguely remember it having bits that you could consider humor. I don't remember much about it. I don't remember it being, you know, like a hilarious movie.
Yeah.
But is it about a basketball player? Or so that becomes a werewolf. Basically, it's Teen Wolf.
Before Teen Wolf. Yeah, that's it. He was ahead of the game.
So, yeah, there was that. And I think it's kind of his idea of like I was a teenage werewolf, that kind of idea of a movie.
Yeah.
So there was that, and what's the other? Oh well, I'm surprised we haven't spoke about this yet. We hadn't spoke about God Told Me To.
Ah, God Told Me To is great.
So if you don't know about it, this was well, this is maybe, what was it, a year or maybe a couple of years after the first It's Alive. So this is a crime sci-fi horror type movie, which has, is it an alien or something? I vaguely recall the alien or something that's making people against. I think it's set in New York, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And they are claiming that it was God that was speaking to them. So of course the people were going around committing murders, and that their claim is always that God told me to. Hence the title of the film.
Yeah.
And I don't. Well, I imagine it's a bit like a lot of Larry Cohen films and, say, Lloyd Kaufman type films. Is they probably have the rights to shoot in certain places, but I'd imagine there's a lot of people probably watching films now who are like, hang on a minute, that looks like me from 1976. I don't remember being in a film.
What the? Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Because he's obviously, Larry Cohen was a New Yorker himself, and so many of his films have this very amazing location filming in the city. And in this case, it has a kind of extraordinary opening section where there's like people shooting from water towers with rifles, people knifing customers in supermarkets. There's a famous moment where Andy Kaufman, who of course was famous from Taxi and played by Jim Carrey in Man on the Moon, but he goes berserk during the St. Patrick's Day parade. So there's all this action in the city.
This is his first film, I think.
Yeah, it would have been 1976.
Before his first film.
In between the It's Alive films, I think between one and two, I'm pretty sure it's. But yeah, you're right. It's extraterrestrial power that's behind this thing, and I suppose I always like God Told Me To, because to me it seems like the ultimate atheist horror film, really, because the main character is this devout Catholic cop played by Tony LaBianco, who ends up finding out that the culprit of all of this is basically, from what I can remember, is this kind of Christ-like Richard Lynch, who was born of a virgin and impregnated by an extraterrestrial demon.
That sounds pretty normal for a daytime like Jeremy Kyle type TV show.
He was a fucking demon, he was.
God told me to, you know.
Alfie was all over me, hands like an octopus. But it's truly strange. And Richard Lynch being, it's got a great cast again.
Well, again, he also wrote and directed, so I presume he must have produced things. He did produce quite a lot of his own films anyway.
Yeah.
I don't recall, because it obviously came out on DVD. I'm not sure if it's ever come out on Blu-ray, but has it got an audio commentary on the DVD?
Yeah, I think so. I doubt I've ever heard it, but God Told Me To, Q, Uncle Sam and a few others were certainly either Anchor Bay or Blue Underground releases back in the days when I was buying loads of DVDs from like America through different sites. Yes. And they always had loads of extras, and that was part of the thing. And I think God Told Me To, the first time I'd actually watched it was on the Blue Underground DVD, I think. I don't believe it's had a Blu-ray release yet, but I may be wrong.
I'm just looking. I can see that Q Winged Serpent was released by Anchor Bay, so probably
yes.
Over here the same. But yeah.
Yeah, God Told Me To is great. I don't think it was that easily readily available in the UK. I don't know if it had a VHS release, but I do know that the first time I watched it was in the early days of DVD, when I had the freedom to just order whatever I liked, had my own job at the supermarket, go on the World Wide Web.
Yep.
Which is still going.
Wait for the dial-up to go. I'm in the basket. I'm gonna. Oh, it's crap.
Are you on the phone again, Stephen? Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dad.
So that would obviously be another film that people would obviously, you haven't heard of Larry Cohen, why not? You'd want to put God Told Me To on there, along with It's Alive trilogy and The Stuff, Cue the Winged Serpent.
Mm.
I would say out of the two blaxploitation films, I've always liked Black Caesar. So I would say put that on there if you'd want to see any of his films. I don't know if you want to talk about any of his other stuff that wasn't really in our in our genre, so like his Edgar Hoover film.
I never watched that, actually. I don't know about that.
So, well, I guess we'll go on to special effects.
Special effects is really good.
Came out in the year I was born.
Oh, 1984, a sexy year for all sorts of reasons. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and you were born.
George Orwell year, yep.
Wow, wow. Yeah, he was right all along, it turns out.
Yep.
George Orwell, Animal Farm and all that. Yeah, special effects is great. Special effects is not that great. Well, it's quite good, actually. But
It's not his best film, but it has...
Years.
If you've seen some of his films and you didn't know this was done by him, you'd be able to tell it was a film by him, certainly.
Yeah, it's a strange one, and I don't think many people talk about it much, but it's interesting. I mean, it's certainly a film that has got him all over it, in the sense of it's about a New York filmmaker, like Larry, who is forced to go back to low-budget filmmaking, like Larry, after being fired from a big Hollywood film, which in this case, as we said, it was either Jury before... Q. It's got Eric Bogosian, who's a really good actor who became famous from Talk Radio, the Oliver Stone film. He's got an early role in this as the filmmaker, and it's one of those very much kind of nudge films, which is all about films. It's interesting from a genre point of view, I suppose, because Zoe Tomerlis is the girl from Miss 45, who died very young, is very good, and is in Bad Lieutenant later on. But she's a kind of wannabe actress who Eric Bogosian kills, and he doesn't really care a shit. He just wants to use the footage of her murder to make a film about her life. He casts a lookalike in her role.
That's what I was going to say when you were saying all these things, that like Larry Cohen did this. Yeah. I'd wait for you to go say something about it's about a director who making a movie based on a murder he committed. I said, no, not like Larry Cohen. Definitely not like Larry Cohen.
Well, that's just it. I mean, it's a very cynical. All of Larry Cohen's films are really cynical about everything consumerism. This is very cynical about Hollywood. And there's a great thing where the detective who's meant to be investigating the murder, actually the thing he's more concerned about is making sure he gets an associate producer credit on the film. Oh, I'll just make sure I'm on the credits. There's some good jokes where the main character is looking through like a pile of photographs for stars that could be in the film. And one of the pictures is Dustin Hoffman dressed as a woman from Tootsie, which was then a recent And it's got kind of a nasty edge. Like, not many Larry Cohen films are that nasty, but I remember there's a couple of scenes in this. There's I think it's a technician that's strangled with a reel of film, and there's the murder of Zoe Tomerlis' character is really quite unpleasant. She's choked to death from what I can remember. But it's another film about everyone wants to be in show business, and they don't really give a toss about what that means. In this case, murdering somebody just so they can get some fame and money. And it's well played. It doesn't quite work, but it is certainly doing that thing about different layers of reality that would become very common in, you know, after Scream and things like that.
Talking of Scream, did you hear there's going to be another one?
Oh God.
Yeah.
Is Nev Campbell free? Of course she's free. She's got nothing else to do.
Steve, as we mentioned in the previous episode, Stephen did write a book about Scream, so I guess he's going to have to do a revised edition when this new film comes out.
Oh, no. Why? Well, that's it. Scream 4 was enough, wasn't it?
I think Scream 2 was enough. But there you go.
It's just desperate. There's nothing more to say.
But yes, that's the thing that's going across the rumor mill at the moment. And I thought, oh, Stephen had to redo his book then. Which, if you didn't know, Stephen wrote a book about Scream, which is available from Monsieur Publishing, Devil's Advocates. Check it up on Amazon Prime or Amazon itself and all these little places. You can pick it up.
Still available.
So, support Stephen. Support.
Oh, I need a lot of support right now. Thank you. Yeah, thank
you. Support Scream.
$9.99.
Well, might be less. About
potentially. Yeah.
So, but sorry about the sidetrack. Just thought I'd quickly mention that as you mentioned it.
Always appreciate it.
Yep, and I suppose after special effects.
Special effects.
And also, we mentioned the stuff at the beginning of this.
The stuff.
We mentioned It's Alive, which...
It's Alive.
We'll have no choice now. It will have to go into Franchise Corner on the website sooner or later, because it's now canon, Steve, and we've not spoken about it.
Yeah, and there is a really, really rubbish remake of It's Alive, isn't there? Which was total rubbish, garbage, nonsense. No, I've kind of forgotten it, but I remember it being something I moaned about for an hour and a half.
When did it come out? It came out.
I don't remember who made it or who's in it, but it was garbage, just total garbage.
While I look that up, I will say the next thing we want to talk about is Return to Salem's Lot, which is a sequel in name, more than anything, than as opposed to being a sequel to Salem's Lot, I would have said.
Oh yeah, completely. Yeah, and I've not watched this for about 30 years. I was going to try and watch it before tonight, but I never got around to it.
Why not?
I'm sorry, boss.
I've got plenty of time.
I'm ever so sorry. I just had work was hectic, really hectic at work. The school run,
the traffic,
all the usual, the traffic. Oh, it's just constant. The world's just never stopping, is it? I mean, if only something could happen that could slow everything down. I have time to watch. Hang on a minute. What? See you in an hour and a half.
Yep.
Yeah. But do you know what? Return to Salem's Lot was like you said, one of those in-name-only sequels that popped up in the 80s and people tended to slam. But I know at least a couple of people that says it's fantastic. And my vague memory is it is the one with the vampire cows. And
yes,
it's very much a bit like It's Alive 3, actually. It very much addresses the fact that it's a film coming out during the mental AIDS paranoia. Where everybody got everything wrong. And yeah, and it's got Michael Moriarty as the hero. But its connection to Stephen King, I would suggest, very, very restricted. Mostly to the point where the title says Salem's Lot. That's about the limit.
Yes.
But it's great, actually, the fact that I don't think there's anything he directed. The writing stuff's a bit different because he was a writer for hire for decades, started out in TV. But the stuff he directed, as far as I can tell, was all things that he had total freedom to do whatever he liked. He talked his way in, that charismatic devil.
Well, I know that Return to Salem's Lot is available on DVD. I don't think it was let's see if I can see it. Yeah. It's on DVD, it's on the shelf. It's not this country, another country. So I don't know if it's actually had a UK release or not. But I mainly picked it up, one, because my completionist side of me said, well, it's like you just said, it's really Stephen King, in name only, as opposed to anything else. It's Salem's Lot, in name only, more than anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it did come out on DVD. I don't know. I suppose it's a lot of these sort of sequels that came out. So The Birds, Land's End. Will we ever see that on a DVD? Will Arrow do a fantastic limited edition box set for that? Maybe, perhaps.
Oh, I hope so.
But yeah, they could do Salem's Lot, but obviously put this on there, a Return to Salem's Lot, you can put that on there because it's worth mentioning.
Yeah And Daryl Buxton, who is the guy that is involved in a lot of Eric McNaughton's books about classic horror, he is a huge champion of Return to Salem's Lot, and it was him actually that a while ago made me think, oh, I must watch that again, because the only time I'd ever watched it was back in the 80s, I presume, when it came out on video. It's released by Warner, so a lot of Coen's films were at least distributed by Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And it was panned, but the vague memories I have of it is it's really strange. It's not, it had a poster with Mr. Barlow on it, but of course Mr. Barlow is nowhere in sight. You do get Michael Moriarty, who's a little different.
Yes.
Separated at birth.
But yeah.
That's so one to rewatch.
I could see somebody putting it out. I mean, the DVD I've got is a legit DVD, but the thing is, I want to say it's an Australian DVD. But yeah, I could see somebody putting it out, because Yeah, it's like Psycho. Somebody could quite easily put Psycho out with the Bates Motel as the 80s pilot episode thing. Have that out come out of it, just because, you know, it's something that maybe not a lot of people would have heard of and potentially want to see, just as a, you know, I've seen it kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just going back to the It's Alive, I've just looked at the sequel was from 2009.
Oh, the remake.
Yeah, the remake.
Yeah.
So, and it was done by, hang on, Joseph Rusnak.
Oh, Joseph.
He did the 13th Floor.
Hmm.
I don't recognize anything else really. Popular, you know, action film type stuff, but yeah. I didn't really remember much of that. I just looked at the poster and I was like, nope, still don't remember it. There we go. And I suppose next thing out of that would be Deadly Illusion, which was a thriller film which had Billy Dee Williams in it, who played Lando Calrissian in the Star Wars films.
Oh, Billy Dee, yeah. I don't think I've seen Deadly Illusion. I've seen Blind Alley, which...
four special effects, I mean, between a few and special effects.
Yeah, there's a couple which are perhaps in the category of less exciting, but I'd be interested to watch Deadly Illusion.
Wicked Stepmother, which of course is that... David film.
Yeah, and I think in King Cohen he talks about working with her, doesn't he?
Yes, we're gonna talk about King Cohen shortly, Stephen. Hold your horses, Stephen. Roll them back.
Christ.
So Wicked Stepmother is a mother-daughter film. So they're a pair of witches who, obviously it's the 80s, so it's a yuppie family, and they're called havoc, and I think they share one body, and one lives in a dog or a cat or something.
Oh, we've all done it.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think they share one body. So Betty Davis and I want to say Barbara Carrera was the other person.
Oh, Barbara Carrera. Yeah.
I want to say that I think it's a case of the sharing one body. So probably Barbara Carrera's character, obviously the young body, not the hot stuff that Betty Davis would have been in 1980.
Oh, yeah.
But hey, just not my.
Each to his own.
But so I would have said it was her character was the attracting all the men and whatever. And I believe while it's going on, the other part of them would have to go into a cat or a dog or some animal anyway while it's going on. And of course, then it's swapped all the way through. So Betty Davis is obviously the wicked stepmother character, really. But all you really tend to see is Barbara Carrera.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's worth watching if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But next after that was The Ambulance.
Oh, The Ambulance is fantastic. Have you watched The Ambulance recently?
I haven't watched it recently. In fact, the last time I watched it was, do you remember when there used to be these things called video rental shops? I don't mean when there's DVDs out. I mean actual video. Yeah, that was the last time I watched it. So I would have said 2001, maybe, would be the last time I watched it.
Oh, God, you're just so 2001.
2001.
No.
Such a space odyssey.
Oh, God, that's so boring, that film. Yeah. Oh, The Ambulance is great. 1990. Oh, that's when it was made and released. And yeah.
It stars your favourite person, though. I remember that. Eric Roberts.
Actually, I did quite fancy Eric Roberts. I'm not embarrassed to say that. Actually, I was slightly embarrassed saying that. But yeah, if you want to watch...
Oh, no choice now, Stephen. It's now recorded. I mean, I could edit this, so it's not there, but I might just leave that bit in.
I'm as heterosexual as the next man. Oh, God, I just saw who the next man was.
I will cut that bit out.
Oh, that's a relief. So, if you're a fan of... Yeah, Eric Roberts. I mean, the thing is, Eric Roberts turns up in such shite now, but Eric Roberts is actually a really good actor. And if you ever watch Runaway Train, which is the great action film from the mid 80s, which is so good, and he's great in it, and John Voight is fantastic, and actually John Voight as well became this weird leering guy in Anaconda and dubious political opinions. But Eric Roberts, who who in the ambulance wears a bunch of skimpy vests, as you'd want him to, and has the best mullet of 1990. I can't prove that, of course. It's just a speculation. But yeah, no, he's great. The ambulance is your film to go to if you've seen Runaway Train already and you want some proof that Eric Roberts is worth supporting, because he's fantastic. He's like in The Ambulance, which is again another mad on the street location film in New York City kind of film from Larry Cohen. He's a comic book artist. He works for Marvel, which means that long before the Marvel films became the Marvel films, Stan Lee turns up as himself, sort of, although I think in the credits he's just called Marvel Comics editor. That's Stan Lee. But now, of course, later on, Stan Lee was popping up in everything, just to kind of with a signpost saying, I'm Stan Lee.
Yeah.
But yeah, he really fancies a girl. She collapses in the street. She gets shiftily taken away by this suspiciously fast arriving ambulance. And the whole film is about him trying to figure out where she's gone. And it's like Maniac Cop, which we'll come to. It's a paranoid film about Larry Cohen's distrust of anybody in authority. So cops before, in this case, hospitals. Don't trust anybody, especially doctors.
Yes.
And he's quite right. You know, in this case, Eric Roberts finds out that a bunch of New Yorkers with diabetes, not Wilford Brimley, though, strangely, are being taken to a special hospital where they're involved in this massive kind of conspiracy, using them as human guinea pigs to make a lot of money, just like the pharmaceutical companies. So, yeah, no, it's really good. It's got loads of Cohen regulars. I'm sorry?
James Earl Jones is in it.
James L. Jones is mental. Red Buttons, isn't it? Yeah, James L. Jones is like the lieutenant that carries on chewing gum even when he's dead.
Yes.
Red Buttons is this very... Red Buttons, who I always... When I was growing up, I was a big... And still, actually, now. But I was always a big fan of 70s disaster movies. And Red Buttons was in... I think it's the Poseidon Adventure. I may be wrong. But Red Buttons is this kind of twitchy, old New York Post reporter that is just excited about this, and he gets some of the best one-liners. Like there's a great one-liner about Florence Nightmare, which sums up the plot of the film. So he's the kind of old-fashioned, fast-talking, long coat, trench coat wearing character that Larry Cohen likes in a lot of these films. But James Dixon from the It's Alive films, Lorraine Landon, they're all in there somewhere as well. It's a kind of gathering together of Larry Cohen's pals and the people he's very loyal to. But it's a really great paranoid New York film, and that's the kind of stuff that Cohen was so good at, and great action as well, as we'll probably mention in a minute with Maniac Cop and all those kind of stuff. But there's great stuff where Eric Roberts is on a runaway hospital trolley and the ambulance drives through a New York nightclub. You know, totally mental. You watch it going, how on earth did he get permission to do? Oh, I get it. He didn't get permission to do this.
Yeah, totally.
But the stunt stuff, which you don't get enough wacky stunts in films these days, because when you watch something that could be a stunt, you realize it's been CGI'd or something. But the stunts in the Larry Cohen films are things that hold up really well. And I suppose there's a sense of Hitchcock type thriller, mystery, conspiracy stuff at the heart of things like The Ambulance. So probably of all Larry Cohen's films, because it's not well known or mentioned enough, The Ambulance is maybe the one to go to as one that needs a bit of extra love.
Well, he's talking of Eric Roberts. Do you remember in the I want to say it's the mid-90s when they were trying to bring Doctor Who back, and it had Paul McGann as the Doctor, and Eric Roberts was in it as the Master.
Yeah, of course. I remember watching that, yeah.
And I always thought, actually, I quite like this. Obviously, it didn't do very well because they were trying to suit it for two different markets. Obviously, the people who are really into Doctor Who, and of course, because it's an American production more than anything, trying to bring in an American market who don't know who Doctor Who is. So it's kind of a mismatch type of thing. But yeah, I always thought Eric Roberts was actually really good as the Master.
So yeah.
He like you said, he does appear in a lot of shoddy type things nowadays, or bit parts in films, but there's every now and again you see him somewhere and you think, you remember how much of a good actor he was.
He's really good.
He's still a good actor. It's just, yeah, I suppose he doesn't get what we would consider the parts. But hey, so I guess the last thing we should mention, really, you mentioned Original Gangsters, which is basically a blaxploitation film done in the mid-90s, which is actually done in a gangland part of America. It's actually being shot in that area. The area where it's being shot is or was known as the gun capital of the world. The amount of people that used to die in there. So all the people actually turning up in it, like, you know, bit part people, they're actually real gangsters. So yeah, why not? I suppose the last thing we need to mention, really, director-wise, would be his Masters of Horror episode, which, of course, stars Michael Moriarty.
Yes, it does.
Pick me up.
With a big old Brooklyn accent.
Oh, yes.
it's big. Yeah, I see, the thing is, I vaguely remember Masters of Horror getting a bit of a slamming from some people, but actually, don't know about you, but from either of the two series that it had, the majority of them are actually really good.
Like any TV series of anything, you'll get the one you're kind of not sure about that.
Yeah.
That one I quite liked. It had Furrows of Bulk in it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely.
And
it's got a mad cast. She's like a runaway, isn't she? And she's involved in this. The two maniacs that are part of the plot.
Yes, and again, Lauren Landon appears, as you would expect her to, because it's a Larry Cohen thing. So, as you mentioned, it's a woman, isn't it? I think she's traveling alone, isn't she? Then she gets picked up by Michael Moriarty, who is such a friendly fellow in this episode. Certainly somebody you want to hang around with, maybe for not too long.
Yeah, because Pick Me Up is mad, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, Moriarty is this brash New York trucker who's got corpses on meat hooks in the back of his truck.
Like I said, somebody you want to hang around with.
Always. And the other guy, the hitchhiker, is this handsome guy that I think it's the only time I've ever seen watching someone being throttled with a live snake. And the two maniacs, and Moriarty's really funny because he's spending most of the episode kind of slagging off the standards of his the other psychopath in the film. But yeah, it's how the paths of these two maniacs kind of come together, really. From memory, it all kind of climaxes in a cheap motel with a woman that's tied to a vibrating bed and kind of tortured by the hitchhiker character. And the twist at the end is, I don't remember much, but the twist at the end is a third psychopath. So there's three maniacs on the loose. But it's very much a Larry Cohen episode. It's got stuff. It's got stunts, which Cohen movies always had some really impressive stunts. It's got a joke about It's Alive, where the Moriarty character talks about seeing baby monsters on a fairground attraction. sounds familiar. And it's got the usual kind of contemporary references. Cohen always stayed relevant, so this one references things like mad cow disease, which was perhaps not a pandemic, but was a thing that people were scared about at the time.
Yes.
Identity theft, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, no, it's a good episode of Masters of Horror. Not the best, but that was the last time. In fact, I think that's Larry Cohen's last directing credit.
That is his last directorial film.
It's a bit of a shame.
TV thing. Well, said, you think of him and you think of all the stuff he's done. You think he's done, you know, maybe 50 plus movies or something. But then we look at his filmography, you're like, oh, actually, he hasn't done as much. But then when you look at his written stuff or stuff he wrote over the years, you're like, oh, that's what he's been busy doing.
Yeah, loads of writing credits. Like, he was when I was a boy. Flashback corner. flashback face. That's my flashback face. That one. When I was a boy growing up in the wilds of Fakenham, I watched things like Star Trek with my dad, but I also watched The Invaders, and which was basically the 60s version of X-Files, where a character called David Vincent would spend every episode trying to convince a bunch of people that there was a conspiracy to cover up alien invasion, and no one believed him, and the aliens basically vanished into dust if he killed them, so he had no evidence. So he was the Fox Mulder of the 60s, and that show was created by Larry Cohen, along with Branded, I think it was.
Yeah, Branded, which the
very much
the main guy in it, who I can't remember his name is at the moment, but the guy who was in it, Chuck Connors, I just remember what his name is, who was in a lot of the Western films and stuff like that. But I always known him as the guy who owns the tourist trap in, appropriately named, The Tourist Trap, the film.
Oh, Tourist Trap's great, yeah.
Yeah, he's the guy who runs the tourist trap film in that film, which, you know, obviously compared to all the other things that was in his career, obviously playing this suave, you know, strong American jeweled hero, and then it's in obviously Tourist Trap, he's playing a very different character. But I always like Tourist Trap; it's one of my favorite full moon films.
Tourist Trap's really good. Yeah, that's underrated as well. But yeah, he had a huge amount of screenplays. The Phone Booth was a script that he wrote of years earlier. And
one of my favorite of those sort of films, you know, stuck in one area type movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been quite a few, obviously, was it Buried with Ryan Reynolds?
Yep.
A load of other ones as well, but that's the one most people would probably know of. But yeah, I've always liked Phone Booth because this was the time when Colin Farrell was pretty much anywhere and everywhere. He was in loads of stuff in one time. Mm. And in this, he shows his acting chops, and I've always wanted to find out, because it's never been told, who was the person who was originally going to do the voice of the killer? Because the story goes that they hired somebody to do the voiceover, who ended up being Kiefer Sutherland's character doing the voiceover, but the voice wasn't sinister enough. So he ended up getting Kiefer Sutherland to come in, which then would have been sort of beginning of 24, would it? Around that sort of time.
Yeah.
So he came in and did the voiceover, and his voice worked perfectly for that film. Yeah, kind of sinisterly and sarcastically saying all these things to Colin Firth. No, I'd be different, completely different film. Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to shoot me. Oh, lovely. Okay.
I don't remember that in Mamma Mia. Just,
let me get Bridget Jones on the phone first.
I think actually the original voice was, I did check it a while ago, the original voice, which wasn't quite menacing enough, was the actor Joe Pasquale.
Oh yeah, I would have kept Joe Pasquale. That's a bit fine, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I think Bobcat Goldthwait auditioned.
Yeah, why not?
Phone Booth was great. Phone Booth, actually, although it was directed by old Joel Schumacher, Phone Booth is the kind of film that could easily have been directed by Larry Cohen, because it has that same thing where they shot it on the streets of New York in a kind of guerrilla style. It's set in real time. It's kind of got that one wobbly camera work, and it feels like it's very current and very of the moment. So, yeah, Phone Booth's really good. And
I guess other than it was Captivity, that's something he did, which...
Oh, that's awful, isn't it? It must have been a rewrite.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I am. Just look on IMDb. I was trying to remember what the woman was in it. It's Alicia Cuthbert.
Oh, yeah, from 24, yeah.
24, yeah. So maybe he's the first person to write the screenplay, and then, of course, they have rewrites. But there's a couple of people listed, so it might just be a case of he obviously did the story, and then, of course, other people come in, studio come in, go, we don't want that, we don't want that. Here's a different, completely different film, eh?
Just yeah.
Title. Cellular, which has got nothing to do with Phone Booth, but that's another thing. I suppose our last talking point, really, other than the thing we would talk at the end, which is King Cohen, we should probably talk about those little known films. Have you ever heard of Maniac Cop?
Maniac Cop.
It's like Psycho. Yeah. He's a maniac instead.
He's a maniac.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. These are great, yeah. Yeah, Maniac Cop, which has a great theme tune, doesn't it? Like, I'm sure it's the second one. It is the second one, which has a Maniac Cop rap at the end.
I don't remember the rap, but that's probably a reason why. That's probably a reason why I haven't remember.
They're on fire or shooting with an Uzi. Yeah, the second one has the.
I know you with your rap music.
I'm really up with the streets. The things,
the mean streets of Fakenham,
what people listen to in the ghetto of Fakenham. Yeah, I'm down with that. Yeah, Maniac Cops, yeah, which he wrote and were all directed by William Lustig, who was himself a prominent guy filming on the streets of New York in Maniac, which is very nasty and very good. What you should do is you should watch the although Maniac Cop 3 is a total mess, you should watch the documentary on the, I think it's the Blue Underground Blu-ray of Maniac Cop 3. Actually, it would be, because it's William Lustig. Hello?
Badger of Silence. Cool.
Oh, yeah, I think it said Badger of Silence, because
Maniac Cop 3, Badger of Silence.
Badger of Silence. But there's a great... The documentary on Maniac Cop 3 is fantastic insight into how things go so badly wrong. Like William Lustig calls it a pot full of piss, and basically talks his way through this awful production where they had no real script. They had a rough cut of the film that came in at 50 minutes, and William Lustig walked off and other people basically wrote additional scenes to pad it out to feature length. So Maniac Cop 3 is more interesting for what went wrong behind the scenes than it is for the strange kind of disjointed film that it is. But the first two are really good. The first one was very influential, actually. For years afterwards, we had loads of other stuff like Vampire Cop and, of course, Psycho Cop and Psycho Cop Returns.
Which Psycho Cop Returns is the better of the two, I'd argue. I've always loved Psycho Cop Returns.
And I forgot to mention it, but in direct-to-video, the documentary that we mentioned earlier, Bobby Ray Schaefer. Turns up as with a nice insight into making Psycho Cop Returns. And that was nice to watch, actually. Maniac Cop is one of the great, before Rudy Giuliano cleaned up New York City, even though he's a total bastard himself, is a great 80s New York film where everybody's nervous and nobody trusts the cops. And it's got that great opening scene where, you know, you follow this girl that's been mugged, which seems to be a daily thing in New York for someone like her. And she takes refuge and she finds a police officer who then throttles her because it's the maniac cop.
Yeah. Who's not a cop, really.
But he is a maniac.
He is a maniac in a cop's uniform.
Mm-hmm.
There's a killer dressed in a police uniform, really. Again, on the streets of New York City.
Yeah.
The streets of New York City were a hellish place to be in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Well, yeah, I've watched
Dead stuff coming out everywhere. People shooting at you from, you know, windowsills. God telling me to do weird and wonderful things.
Oh, God told me to. Yeah, and it's got the St. Patrick's Day parade again, like, which, again, from vague memories, I think they shot without any permission to capture something that adds a lot of production value. Everybody turns out, Richard Roundtree and Tom Atkins, Laureen Landon, of course. Bruce Campbell is that character that's suspected of being the murderer, even though it's ridiculous and the audience is going, it's not him.
Robert Zadar.
Yeah, and the nastiest bit is the flashback stuff, isn't it, where you see him being slashed in the showers in the prison, in the backstory.
Nasty.
Oh, it's so nasty. It's Maniac Cop, one of those very, very popular video films of the late 80s that I think got a lot of rentals.
Obviously, they are two very completely different trilogy of movies, but what has always been your favourite out of the two, the It's Alive trilogy or the Maniac Cop trilogy?
Yeah, before it was always the Maniac Cop films, because I think I just watched those a lot more. back in the old video days. And they do have some mad stunts, like the bit in the second one where the woman is handcuffed to the car with no driver and thrown into the traffic. Mental, absolutely mental. And
it's
the fact that
it's handheld driving. Yeah, look.
Just, I mean, yeah, Cop 2's even got an extra serial killer because it's not enough just to have him in it. You've got the hairy guy that's strangling women and punishing the bad ones. They have a totally mad cast, Bruce Campbell and stuff. But having rewatched the It's Alive films and knowing how weird and flat and not that good Maniac Cop 3 is, I would probably say the ones that hold up better are the It's Alive films, because they're good all the way through and they have a lot of ideas. And he had, because he directed them and produced them and wrote them, he had total control over the It's Alive films. And that shows. Whereas the Maniac Cop films, the first two are actually quite great, but the third one was totally wrecked. And it does kind of show there that he was just the original writer, and his script meant nothing by the end of part three, because there wasn't enough to sustain a movie anyway. The It's Alive films, I think, are the ones that hold up by some way as the better franchise.
I think that would be fair to say. I mean, yeah, a lot of people's going to have a lot of love for the first Maniac Cop, if anything.
Yeah, which is fun.
But yeah, I think It's Alive trilogy are the better of the two. Like I said, they are very different, completely different films. It's like trying to compare Citizen Kane with, I don't know, Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
They're two very different films.
Oh, yeah.
So, I guess the only thing we've got left to talk about, Stephen, really, is this little-known documentary that came out a couple of years ago, maybe last year, maybe the year before. Larry Cohen, or King Cohen, as he's known as.
King Cohen.
King Cohen.
Yeah, so, King Kong.
As you would imagine, Stephen, this documentary is all about Larry Cohen. And it's definitely worth watching, especially if you... Obviously, as we've been talking about his career anyway, but a lot of his career. So it was a documentary, I think it's about 2 hours long. So the whole title is King Cohen, The Wild World of Filmmaker Larry Cohen. And obviously it goes, there's a lot of talking head scenarios where, you know, people that worked with him in various movies. But he does go quite in depth in a lot of his movies prior to anything. I think J.J. Abrams turns up in it somewhere on the line.
Yeah, he's... J.J. holds... J.J. in... J.J., as I call him.
J.J. had coffee the other day.
He's holding the It's Alive baby while he's
wrestling. But yes, it's a feature-length documentary talking about, you know, Larry Cohen and all of his films and careers, which is basically kind of what we just done, but in a shorthanded version of it. But
yeah,
it is available to watch on Amazon. I checked it earlier. It is available on Amazon, and it's available everywhere places. Well, Shudder is the one of the places you can watch it. But it's definitely a documentary worth checking out, especially if you're a fan of Larry Cohen's work, and obviously now he's passed, you just want to have just that little bit more of Larry that you couldn't have. A bit like The Stuff, but this one you can have just a little bit more of.
You want more Larry inside you. Yeah, it's great. There's loads of great anecdotes. He's really unpretentious. He tells it how it is because he's a straight talking New York Jew, and he's got loads of yarns. He's a good yarn spinner. He talks about, he's really excited because he talks about getting loads of shots of people panicking on the streets of New York, but only because basically by doing their big action scene on top of the Chrysler Building, a lot of people on the streets below thought that the actors firing machine guns were terrorists that were attacking the city. So
that's
brilliant.
The story with the Chrysler Building is always that they were allowed to shoot the film in it, but it was only allowed to go up so far. But of course nobody was actually watching what they were doing, you know, part of the building. So they kind of went, well, we'll just go up a little bit higher and a little bit higher and a little bit higher. Oh, we'll just use these bits while we're here as well. And as nobody's paying attention, and of course they probably watch the film, hang on a minute, we didn't give them permission to do
that. It's brilliant. There's some great stuff in there.
It's like a lot of the people that used to do films, it still happens now. You know, people, if they can get away with shooting something there and then without having the permission to do something, do it. Do it before somebody comes along and tells you you can't do it.
Yeah.
So, like they said, you like the St. Patrick's Parade in God Told Me To, obviously you get a good-looking scene, which doesn't cost you anything because obviously you're not doing it for you haven't paid anybody to have the license to be able to do it. You're just doing it because it's there and it makes your film look bigger than what it actually is.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, overall, Larry Cohen was a master of cinema, Stephen.
He really was. And the thing in the documentary is that it's very touching because he's someone that gave work to people that weren't getting work. And Bette Davis in Wicked Stepmother, who had basically had a stroke and was dying of cancer, he gave her a role when nobody else was employing her. Yes. And the hilarious thing about Q, which is that he was fired from either Jury, but by being fired, he was determined to get another movie shot and finished before either Jury was released. So he went out and thought, oh, fuck it, and made Q.
Yeah, either Jury and Q came out in the same... in the same... it's on the audio commentary of Q the Winged Serpent. He talks about it and he says that he made the film and both films came out at exactly the same time, the same week. And his film was, Q the Winged Serpent, was being shown in a cinema two blocks away from where Ida Jury was being shown in a different cinema down the road. So that's kind of funny in a way. Like, oh, watch Larry Cohen. Oh, actually, I'll watch this one and pop down there at 10 o'clock and watch the other one.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's fantastic.
But there we go. So yeah, that's the stuff, Stephen. That's the stuff, and all about Larry Cohen. And I think we've given people enough about Larry.
Oh, you can never have too much now. You know, he was really fascinated by how angry babies are when he made It's Alive, and that makes it babies do look angry, don't they? All red faced and defecating.
Yeah,
but lying in their own filth.
Yeah, well, they're not supposed to be really lying, and it should be. Parents should be responsible when looking after them properly.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I suppose that's...
But there we go. So I guess it was time to wrap this up, Stephen, for this episode.
Yeah, there's a lot to do. Got to get to work in the morning. Oh, I forgot.
We'll carry on for another 6 hours then.
Go to the shop. Oh, no, that's closed. I'm sure there is something to do tomorrow.
I've got nothing else to say about Larry Cohen. I imagine we could talk about him for a while, but yeah, we shall wrap this up now. So next episode, Stephen, will be going live on 24th of April 2020. Like every time, it's the last Friday of the month. And next episode, Stephen, in Retro Rewind, we'll be talking about the 1985 movie directed by Hal Barwood, I think that was his name. Hal Barwood. Is the 1985 film Warning Sign, which seems quite appropriate for this
Warning film. Sign.
The world we're in right now. So we'd be talking about that, and I suppose just virusy pandemic type movies throughout cinema history, I suppose.
Yeah.
I suppose we probably won't mention any zombie films because we could be here for all of a very long time talking about that, if you include virus movies like that.
Oh, yeah. Let's go for the zombie-less virus horror movies.
There you go. So Warning Sign is your thing, which I'm actually quite looking forward to rewatching. It's been a while since I rewatched it.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about virusy pandemic movies, which don't include, as Stephen said, zombies, because we will be having a zombie episode coming up very, very soon.
With
somebody else, Stephen. There'll be three of us.
Three of us. A menage a trois.
Exactly.
At last.
And on that note, if anybody's ever seen a picture of us, you that scary thought in your head. We will. As always, this podcast is available on majority of podcast providers. Just search Horror Screams Podcast. Obviously, follow or subscribe or whatever the on whatever podcast thing is, do click the like button or whatever, so you keep notified of when we're going to be going on. Next episode goes live 24th of April 2020. So I guess we'll just have to give people a nice little a warning, Stephen, about how it is at the moment now.
Just
to be safe out there. Obviously, follow whatever your government's saying for you to do, and make sure you follow those rules, because this pandemic that's going to go on will not finish anytime soon if people do not listen to what their governments are saying. And if you think it's bad now, imagine what it'll be like in 6 months' time if this sort of thing has not ended.
I mean, I get that there's the advice is really complicated. I mean, the phrase "stay at home" it's really quite confusing.
Yeah,
stay at home or die en masse.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite
very confusing. Yeah.
So I said every government around the world has got their own different legislations they're putting forward, and a lot of countries are following it. But there's always a minority. The matter in whatever it is, there's always people that will always think, you know, they got a god complex, so they think they're immortal, so they will go off and carry on willy nilly like normal, as if nothing's going to happen. But as we've said previously to each other, that's the case of it's those sort of people that makes these sort of things worse, because you don't know what they're passing on. So yeah, just follow your government's advice and be safe, and hopefully somewhere along the near future all this will be a distant memory, and hopefully it would be as appropriately as the next film was going to be called Warning Sign, as be a warning sign for the future.
Yeah.
So until then, it's goodbye from me.
Ooh, and good night from me as well. Do stay safe.
Yeah, exactly.